Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Good afternoon, folks, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Okay, everyone, we're back again for another episode of Talking Twilight Zone. My name is Lynn. I'm your host, and I also want to welcome my co-hosts, Bobby, Neer, and Robert. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. And today we're discussing the episode titled A Most Unusual Camera. And I'm going to turn it over to Robert for the opening clip.
Wait a minute, Lynn. Didn't we just discuss this 5 minutes ago? Oh, never mind. I'll go ahead and play the clip.
And now, Mr. Serling.
In this $28 a day hotel suite live three human beings who have larceny in them from their toes to where they part their hair. Amongst the loot of one evening's caper is this camera, which they soon discover has most unique properties. It takes pictures of the future. Stick around for the development on the Twilight Zone.
Okay, thank you, Robert, my wonderful and smart-ass co-host.
No problem.
And before I begin, I would like to once again welcome Dave from England and Randall Thor. Thank you for being here today. Now, A Most Unusual Camera is about a couple of small-time crooks, a husband and wife named Chester and Paula Diedrich, who burglarized an antique shop, or I guess it was a curio shop. And Chester, he's less than thrilled with what they got. But they did get up, or end up getting, a most unusual camera. They realize that this camera takes pictures of events 5 minutes into the future, 5 minutes before they happen. Now, they're staying at a hotel, and Paula's low-life brother, Woodward, shows up out of nowhere at their door. While Woodward is watching a horse race on TV, Chester gets the bright idea to take the camera to the racetrack to predict the outcome of the races in advance. And that's what they do, and they make a killing at the track. When they're back at the hotel counting their loot, a nosy French waiter shows up, sees the camera, and tells them they can only take 10 pictures. So while fighting over how to use the last 2 pictures, Chester and Woodward fall out the hotel window to their death. Now, Paula gets over losing her husband and brother rather quickly and starts to pack away the money. She then takes the camera and shoots the final picture of the two men on the ground below. For posterity, of course. Now, the French waiter then returns. He tells her he's going to take her money, and if she calls the cops, she'll be in serious trouble for Chester and Woodward's death. He then looks at her last photo and tells her there are more than 2 bodies on the ground. She runs to the window, trips over a cord, and falls to her own death. The waiter happily walks to the window with his bag of money, only to notice that there are 4 bodies in the photo. We see him drop the camera. The focus is then on the camera. We hear him yell, and he, too, is now out the window. The end. Well, okay. Gene Carson and Fred Clark, they played the roles well, as did the dim-witted brother, Woodward. But come on. I give this episode an average rating, but I got to be honest here. This had to have one of the stupidest and worst endings of any Zone episode. It made no sense, and I think it left most people scratching their heads. Personally, I think Gene Carson could have easily knocked the crap out of that tiny little weasel of a waiter. But there's no indication whatsoever of how the waiter fell out the window, and by all accounts, there's no reason why he should have. I mean, talk about an open-ended ending to a show. I gave it an average rating because the idea for the show was okay, but the ending was terrible. Thank goodness the man, John Rich, he went on to greater success later when he produced and directed the hit comedy All in the Family. So as I said, I give it an average rating, but the ending, I would give a 0 rating to the ending, the show premise itself. I'll give it an average. It was okay as far as the premise, but why couldn't they come up with a better ending than that? Robert, what do you think?
Yeah, I kind of agree. I give this an average. I give it a 2 out of 5. It's a very predictable story. You pretty much know from the beginning to the end what's going to happen, even if you've never seen this. If it's the first time you've seen a 1960, you have a pretty much a good idea of what's going to happen. You know,
but you know the waiter was going to fall out the window?
Maybe
at the end?
That little twist. I knew basically the three, something was going to happen to them by using the camera, that you know they're going to meet their fate or their end on that one. But the waiter, it seems like he was taking the money from them, and when they took the money and the stuff that they did from the use of the camera, they had what happened to them happen. And it just kind of figures that when he took the picture of the courtyard and showing how many bodies there were, that that's what happened to him. I think if he would have just went into the room, took the money and left, would have ended it right there. But that
there would have been no ending,
Yeah, it'd be that little twist. I just didn't like the ending to this, is the only thing.
It made no sense.
Well, of course, this was written by Rod, and it was very much just a straightforward story, pretty much. I mean, you know, here this is, here's the story, here how it ends. Just like Friday the 13th cursed object thing, you know, what is the cursed object of this week? Well, the cursed object of this week is a camera. Or, you know, the cursed object is a mirror. Or, you know, what this story felt like, pretty much. You know, you have the dim-witted brother in this one, and then you have the sister that's not that far dim-witted. The funny part where Chester's trying to explain to him the whole situation of going to the track and taking the picture of the board before the results go up, before the race is even won.
Yeah, would it really have taken that long to figure that out?
Well, the dim-witted brother there, I mean, Woodrow, how long did it take him? About a minute to finally figure out what the whole thing was?
He couldn't get it. He didn't get it. And come on, are people really that stupid?
His sister was faster than he was on the draw trying to figure that thing out. Yeah, my two endings I would have loved for this, and, you know, I stated when I did my review, was either the final pit, they have the fight, the camera drops on the floor, picture comes up, and it's a picture of the camera. And then they disappear, meaning they go, the camera takes them inside. And then with the waiter,
if he
takes the last picture, you know, he takes a picture, he sees the courtyard, the waiter looks over at the courtyard, he trips on the wire, and he falls out the window. There's the end for that one. Or the other ending, which really wasn't much of an ending, with him going in there, taking the money, and taking the camera with him, thereby repeating the whole thing over again. We wouldn't see it, but that's where Rod would come in and give his little thing as the waiter exits the door with the camera and the money. Yeah.
I like the idea of them being sucked into the camera.
Yeah, that would have been cool.
Yeah, they could have worked with that.
That was just the only... Well, that was the thing that I had the problem with. I just felt that the ending could have been a little bit more better. This was, like I said, just basically an average story for me. And, you know, there were some moments in there where kind of funny. It reminded me of the Back to the Future, where the second one where Marty goes back with the doc and tries to help his kids and goes in and gets the sports almanac, and he's going to take it back with him and, you know, to win on the games, but Doc catches him, he tosses it, and then Biff ends up with it, and then you get the skewed, what is it, 1985, 1987 timeline or whatever. So I was kind of thinking of that when they were going to the race and betting on the horses, and I thought it was kind of neat. Actually, there were some other ones I was thinking of. When I was a kid, well, not really a kid, we know the when they redid the Twilight Zone back in 85, that was pretty much where I graduated from college, and I was just starting into going to the workforce. And one of the episodes that I refer to as a possible ending for this one was the one called Still Life. And with that one, it had Robert Carradine in it, and he finds an old camera in the bottom of that antique trunk that he bought. He develops the pictures, releases the images in the photograph that was trapped in the camera. It's kind of neat because I have on my desk here, and I wrote that I wrote on my review that I had a Brownie Target 620 camera, and also I have a 1915 Kodak box camera in my hand right now.
Oh, wow.
It don't have no film in it, but the Brownie 620 does. I never got the film developed in it, and I imagine it's kind of impossible unless you know someone to do that to try to develop it now. But let me go ahead and play that clip from the 85 Twilight Zone.
Hey, Becky!
What is it?
Well, I'm not sure. Oh, man. Look at this.
What is it?
It's a Kodak 100.
Is that good?
It's fantastic. See, the 100 was the first camera to use roll film. It's the first really modern camera. Look at it, it's mint.
Do you think the people that sold the trunk knew it was in there?
No. I don't think anybody's been in here in years. There's film in it.
What?
There's film in this camera.
Well, it can't be any good, not after all this time. Can it?
It's not impossible. Seals are good. I got something I want to show you. I got some photographs of a National Geographic expedition. 1913 to the Amazon River Basin.
You have no photographs. There can be no photographs.
Alex, do you know about this expedition?
I was on it. January 1913.
Yeah, the expedition to study...
You studied the Kodakai.
Yes.
I was a boy, just 13, apprentice to Dr. James Levinson. I thought I was going on an adventure. As a matter of fact, I was lucky to escape with my life.
Why?
The Kodakai held many stringent spiritual beliefs. In particular, that to make an image of them, such as a drawing, was to steal their souls, their very selves. When they learned what our expedition camera could do, they turned on us and smashed our equipment. We broke camp immediately. Got as far from the Kodakai village as we could before nightfall. I'll never forget that night when the Kodakai stalk their prey. They communicate by imitating the wind. Eeriest sound you'll ever hear.
And that was the famous John Carradine in that one. So, yeah, in
who
that
also,
one.
Who also played Brother Jerome in The Howling Man.
Yep. Yep. So he, some of the ones that appeared in the Twilight Zone in the old series also appeared in the new series as well in certain roles. But, yeah, I remembered that one. I couldn't remember the title at first, so I had to hunt the title up, but I remember that ending, you know, from years ago when I watched it, and just so happened to find it. If anybody does want to watch that, it is on YouTube up there. Of course, it's broken in parts, but the whole thing's up there. So, another series that I used to watch, which didn't run very long, it only ran from November to January of 1981, and I don't know if anybody remembers or not, it's called Dark Room. And Dark Room had James Coburn kind of doing Rod's role, where it would, you know, go start in a photograph room, and then he would show you the picture, and then it would go off into the series. So,
I remember here, that one.
Yeah, here's a quick promo for it.
Beckoning you, draw you into the darkness, to the terror that awaits you in the dark room.
There you are.
Yeah, I'm glad you came.
Come on in. Something I want to show you.
Friday.
Hello, I'm James Coburn. I know you'll be joining me in the dark room.
James Coburn hosts stories of mystery and suspense, spine-tingling twists and turns.
Back to
sold him to me?
You were. The stories that scare. Dark Room, Friday.
It ran on ABC and was canceled after 15 episodes.
Yeah, I don't remember that one at all.
Yeah. I used to watch it off and on then when the Sci-Fi Channel, or we call it SIFI now, came aboard. They used to run canceled series in the afternoon and sometimes in the evening. And Dark One was one of them that they ran. And my last one I got is the trailer for, of course, Friday the 13th, the series. And in that one, it had double exposure, which is about whoever the owner of the camera takes a picture, and he has his own doppelganger to do the killing for him.
The strangest things come to life on Friday the 13th.
Who is it? Who's there?
It's a body double whose only mission in life is death.
Get him.
But which one is real, and which is the killer clone?
The machete killer has claimed another victim.
No!
Be ready for twice the terror on Friday the 13th, the series. Next week, there's nothing to fear but fear itself.
But I do remember that episode. It's about a reporter that uses his doppelganger to do the killings so that he could get the credit. Just some examples of evil cameras, so to say. So 2 out of 5 was my rating, so I'll go ahead and pass that on to Bobby.
All right, thank you, Robert. Forgive me for saying this yet again, but we've seen this all before, and not that long ago in this series. Earlier in season 2 with the man in the bottle, where that elderly couple gets a bottle and a magic genie, several wishes to go along with it, and just like here, they squander the opportunity. The only difference is they don't all end up dead like this group. Lynn and I gave that episode a 1 rating, and things haven't changed much, at least for me. Doesn't matter whether it's a bottle that gives you wishes or a camera that shows the future. It's all the same thing, the chance to change the future, know what it is, and make it profitable for yourself. It didn't work for them, and it doesn't work here either. That episode was dead serious, especially when the husband made a wish that turned him into Adolf Hitler when he wanted world power. But unlike that story, every time I watch this episode, I get the feeling that it wasn't really meant to be taken seriously. Although there aren't any real laughs in it and everyone does perish, it still seems like one of those times when this series tries to be amusing. I mean, here we have a trio of small-time criminals that luck into a possible million-dollar camera, and all they do is squander the opportunities by going to the racetrack, winning some cash, and then arguing with each other. If this is a low comedy, I don't know what it is. So this time I went searching online and found some interesting things about the lead actors. Both of them are better known for comedy roles than dramatic ones. If you're old enough like I am, then you can recognize both Gene Carson and Fred Clark from dozens of appearances on sitcoms, usually, during the 50s and 60s. This is what IMDb has to say about Gene Carson. All this shapely character blonde had to do was open her mouth to induce laughter, and so she did, primarily on TV during the 50s and 60s. And although she milked that unmistakable rasp for all it's worth, she also showed great comedy sense. Fans of the old Andy Griffith Show might even remember her from a classic episode where her character, Jolene, was partnered up with two other women as three dames hiding out from the law who hold both Deputy Barney and flew hostage while putting designs on them at the same time. It's one of my favorite episodes. And it really is very amusing. And the same thing can be said about Fred Clark. IMDb had this to say about him. This popular, baggy-eyed, bald-domed, big lug of a character actor had few peers when called upon to display that special slow-burn style of comedy. Few others perfected, but perfect he did on stage, film, and TV. In fact, he pretty much cornered the market during the 50s and 60s as the dour, ill-tempered guy you love to hate. And last but not least, as Lynn has already mentioned, this episode was directed by John Rich, who had an amazing career on early TV and all through the 60s especially, directing mainly sitcoms, not only All in the Family, but the original Dick Van Dyke Show, That Girl, and all the way down to Gilligan's Island. He even directed that. He's still around, by the way. He's 86 years old. So taking that all into account, I can only believe they were trying to be funny here. A trio of dimwit, small-time con men and one woman, too stupid to parlay something that falls right into the laps of the cash, literally without falling out the window. Duh. The problem here for me is that I don't like them. When I watch a story, I try to get involved and either hate or like the main characters. Here I can only shrug and say, who cares? In my original review on the board at the Twilight Zone Group, I compared it to the remake of Ocean's 11. In that film, the main characters are also con artists, but they're all also so good-looking and amusing and intelligent and charming that when they walk away at the end of the movie having successfully stolen a fortune in casino money, they actually feel good about it. In this Twilight Zone episode, I can only say the three of them ended up where they belong, dead on the ground. I mean, how stupid can you be? You get a camera that can show you the future and you take it to the racetrack? I can think of better ways to use it. How stupid are they? Not even smart enough to close the window before they all fall out of it, including the waiter. And this episode isn't funny enough to get a much higher rating than the one I gave it on the board. And that's one. I don't get anything out of it. It's a shame because I think it has possibilities. On the past several shows, I complained about those episodes we discussed where nothing was happening. The one where there were, you know, Stevens found out she was a robot, and the last one where the guy was whining about his dead wife. Really didn't have anything. This has too much in it. In the 23 minutes allotted to it, we don't know anything about them, and, you know, it's all too quick. It looks hurried, like they had to get too much in there. And I just, like I said, I just really don't care what happens to them. And I have one more thing to say about all these idiots, whether it's in this story or some other series or the ones that Robert mentioned, there's the clips he played, that characters, whenever they find something falls into their lap, like it's a chance to predict the future or a camera like this or a genie pops up and says you have three wishes, they don't stop and think about it at all. They got to do something right away. Here's a hint. Just sit down, and unless you're given a time limit, think about how you can use it the best. Give yourself a day or a week or a month or more to sit down with a pencil and a paper and write down the things you could do that will make your life more comfortable, and then use it that way. But every one of them does the same thing. They got to have money right away. They got to have everything right away, and that's how they get into trouble. So, like I said, I don't really have any feelings about them. It's a pity. I think there are possibilities. I would have rather seen it. I don't care whether they all die at the end or they end up in the camera or whatever, but I just wanted to see something a little more compelling than just a bunch of idiots fall out the window. I think I don't like the Twilight Zone when it tries to be funny. This is not the only time it tries to do that. Now, a lot of people might say, there's nothing funny about people falling out the window. Well, I don't really think this is a serious story. I really don't. The criminals are too stupid. And all of the actors in it are better known for comedy. Trouble is, there's no laughs. There's just nothing really in it for me. So it's really disappointing. I didn't give it a zero. It's good enough to sit through, but I wouldn't pull it out of the DVD set, and I wouldn't seek it out on the marathon when it's on TV.
Bobby?
All right, and that's it for me. Yeah, what?
I think what? Rod just sometimes got into a rut when he did his writing.
Indeed.
I mean, he does brilliant writing, but there are just other times where he just gets into a format.
Oh, yeah.
And just keeps doing it, the same thing, but into different situations.
Exactly. There are a lot of times in this series when stories are repeated, just given a little different twist, and we let him get away with it because, well, the series is still fascinating, and it's still really good writing. But, you know, if you look a little deeper, and you think about it, you get this odd feeling that you've seen this before. We're going to see a lot more of this in all the episodes we have to do yet, where things are going to come back again and again and again. And for a while, it gets a little tedious. I'm not a professional writer, and I can imagine what it's like to have to come up with something over and over and over again. You, like you said, you get into a rut, and you think to yourself, let's do that again. We'll change a little bit. Nobody will notice the difference. Unfortunately, you do.
Well, he did that even with, like, Templeton, like the trouble with Templeton. And then
sure.
A few episodes later, he did it with Static, where, you know, you've got people who want to go back to the past.
Exactly.
And they do end up going back to the past. And it's almost the same story, just a few episodes short of each other, you know?
That's right. If you're going to do it in different seasons. Don't do it
exactly.
Don't do it in the same season. I just saw
that's
the couple
right.
with the bottle, so I don't need to see
that's
these
right.
all risks. All right, Lynn, that's it for me.
Okay, now Dave, what are your thoughts?
Well, lots of things, and Bobby's made a lot of interesting points there, most of which I agree with. One I don't agree with, but just to come back to that final thing about him repeating his ideas, one of the things that they say in stories is that there are only basically three or four plots. You know, people go on a quest, they've lost something, they go for revenge, and they have a court. You know, there's only about five basic plots. So this is episode 46. It's not surprising that there is some repeat ideas. And I've said on a number of these shows before, Rod Sterling always tries to get at least two stories out of every idea he comes with. And usually the second of the two is a flip of a previous story. Not necessarily a recent previous one, but one that he's done another time in the series. I definitely do. Let me say the thing I don't agree with, Bobby, two things. Is one that the fact about them squandering their things. The pictures going off, the first one went off before they even knew the camera was had these powers. Secondly, one went off during the struggle. It was an accident. Thirdly, the bloke did have a little bit of a plan, in as much as the racetrack was there and then, and they did go for the long odd races, and they seemed to be earning, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, which, remember, 1960 is quite a big fortune. I mean, he was going to buy two cars for $14,000 each. So, I mean, it was a fairly momentous sum that they'd gained on the six races in that day, and they were still going to go back the next 2 days, for two more races. The other thing is the planning aspect. By definition, the characters in this are the losers, the drifters, the, you know, people who always, you know, I never had any luck, life's never been good to me type of person. They're not the person that would have planned and all that, because if they would, they wouldn't have been in that sort of downtrodden situation where, you know, they're robbing, for heaven's sake, a blooming curio shop. Let me see, one or two other things. I think one of the keys, and I think Bobby's right in the fact that it was intended to be an amusing episode, is the air date. It actually aired on the 16th of December, 1960. The one that follows on after this is Night of the Meek, which is sort of a Christmassy one. So I think they were trying to soften the tone, ready for the Christmas episode coming up the following week. I also agree with Bobby that the actual cast were picked for being well-known in comedy roles. And indeed, the director, John Rich, as you said, he'd directed quite a few comedy things himself. Dick Van Dyke Show and things like that. And he also went into partnership with Henry Winkler as well. So I thought it was pretty good. If there are any criticisms, and there probably are, is that it was a light story. I also agree with Robert that the way the waiter was used was probably wrong. Rather than him robbing them, I would have liked in some way if the accidents had happened, as it were, but maybe the money fell out the window with them and got blown away to the four corners of the world. And when the waiter came in, the only thing that was left in the room was the camera. And you have a little final sting in the tail where he takes the camera back to the curiosity shop, you know, to pawn it. And then the shop owner, you know, we see him stick another 10 blank sheets in the camera and puts it back in the window. I.e. a little bit like, as Bobby referred to, the genie's bottle ended up in the actual waste paper basket outside the curio shop in an earlier story. But perhaps we would have criticised that for reusing the same idea. One amazing thing to me is that I can't believe how old people looked in the 60s. The main two characters, the chap was only 46 and the lady only 37. But they sort of look like a real middle-aged couple. I mean, when I saw him, I thought he's sort of, you know, in his mid-50s. And
she was people always looked so much older back then.
Yeah,
supposedly 30 years old. They looked like they were 45 or 50 years old.
Yeah, absolutely. And So that's the main thing. And the one little reminder, well, two reminders. One reminder of a Twilight episode. It reminded me slightly of the Nick of Time one, with the one where they kept pulling the cards out of that fortune telling machine. Because of course he does say with this camera, there doesn't seem to be any way to access it. So there didn't seem to be any way for new photographic sheets to get inside it, which was why I like the idea of perhaps that French guy, you know, handing back it, and then you're seeing the shop owner, you know, opening some sort of secret drawer and putting some more paper in. But never mind. What else? There was one more thing, and then I'll finish. Where's it gone? It's gone. Has it gone? I think... Oh, no, it isn't. For Robert's benefit, one of the things it reminded me of was a film called Memento, Robert, where the chap has no memory, and the only way he can keep his short-term memory going is by keep taking pictures. I don't know if you can bring that picture to mind.
Yeah, that was a very good movie, because the picture itself worked backwards, which was very nice the way they did that. But yeah, he would always take pictures to, like you said, remind himself because of the short-term memory being gone. But then that's where you had, you know, other people messing with his mind. Very untrustworthy people he was around with. So. Yeah.
What, is this a movie? This is a movie?
Yeah. Memento, yeah.
Memento, I never saw that.
Christopher Nolan directed it.
Yeah, huh. With Guy Pearce, Carrie Ann Moss. This is one I'm not really enthused about. I think Bobby's probably, I'm more with Bobby on this than most of the ones. I think really, they really needed to turn the comedy element up a little bit higher in one sense. I think the funniest point for me was how quickly the lady got over the grief.
Oh my poor brother, oh my husband. Oh well, I'll just rack up this money.
Yeah. And her eyes alight upon the pile of money, and say, "Oh well, I'll soldier on." So I can only give it 2 out of 5 myself. But I think one of the light ones, and I think definitely the placing of it being, broadcast 16th of December, they were lightening the tone up, ready for a Christmas episode, and perhaps if it had been placed elsewhere in the schedule, you would have thought it was too much of a lightweight one. But yeah, I liked it. And that was one more thing I was trying to remember. The actor that Bobby mentioned, I mean, I remember him from, what was it? I've forgotten his name now.
Fred Clark?
Yeah. Yes, he was in... he played the neighbour in Burns and Allen, and he was in the Beverly Hillbillies
Fred
as
Clark,
well.
Fred Clark.
So,
yeah, I remember.
I think you can forgive this one because it was leading up for Christmas, but it was definitely a lightweight episode and a tongue-in-cheek one.
I like to know where this character was so bright to come up with the line about helping mankind.
Oh, yeah, he was going to...
And that lasts until the racetrack.
The camera to humanity, exactly.
No way.
We're going to make a lot of money. How with humanity? Exactly. Oh, well. Yeah, okay. This definitely was not one of the better ones, but the ending was absolutely terrible. I mean, if only you knew how the waiter went out the window, and you never knew that. I mean, why did he go out the window? But there was no reason for that to happen. He's just standing there with the camera. So... that ending was ridiculous, but you know, like Dave said, it's pushing up toward Christmas, and they just threw this one in for posterity, I guess. You know.
Well, you see how stupid they are. Okay, the two guys go out. We know why they go out the window, because they trip over the wire. You
right,
see the wire. This is almost like an Alfred Hitchcock thing, where like from Rope or one of them, where he shows the object right there, you know, or he shows the bomb right there, and they still act around, not knowing that it's there, and. Mm-hmm. That wire is there, and you mean she's not that bright that she can't see that wire sticking out when she goes over the window?
Right now, Robert, she was not.
And the Raider too. He turns around,
right.
Does the same thing.
Well, my reading of that, Robert, was that they actually fell over because they were fighting. But in their, they didn't trip over the wire. In their fighting, they moved
That's
the rug,
right.
which, then exposed the wire. And she was the one that tripped on the wire, telephone wire, whatever it was, cable.
Right, right. Yeah. But the waiter had no reason to fall at all. I mean, he just was just standing there looking at the photo, and the next thing you know, he drops the camera on the floor because he sees his own body out there, and then you hear, oh, and he goes out. Now, why did he go out the window?
Basically, inevitability, because, you know, he thought he was so smart ass, and, yeah, there's more than two bodies. Hang on a minute, there's three. And the sheer shock of that, he just overbalanced.
Maybe.
I think he just caught his foot on the freaking wire
yeah,
and not looking again.
It was a little bit weak. I would have rather she sort of fall over the window and take all the money with it, and you see it fluttering in the wind to all corners of the wind. And the only thing left for him to do was to pick up the camera and take it back to the curio shop.
Yeah, and I would have liked the disappearance situation where the picture is of the camera itself and they all just disappear. I think that would have been cool.
Yeah.
If that would have happened.
Well, anyway, just the ending, I think the ending sucked. But other than that, you know, it was a cute little episode to throw out toward Christmas time. And which brings me to our next point is 2 weeks from now, we will be doing, we will be discussing Night of the Meek with the wonderful, fabulous comedy actor Art Carney, who we all remember from The Honeymooners. So this episode is a Christmas episode, the one and only Christmas episode that Rod Serling ever did for The Twilight Zone. And we'll be doing that on March 12th, Saturday, March 12th, Night of the Meek, starring the inevitable, indisputable, unbelievable Art Carney. None of those words made sense today.
I want to say, if people want to go ahead and rewatch the show, and also, there's a commentary for Night of the Meek, if they want to go ahead and listen to that commentary while they watch the show itself.
There is a wonderful commentary done by the wonderful Robert.
Oh, gosh, you're making me blush.
I know.
Be like the Tin Man from Wizard of Oz. Oh, gosh. Or the lion, Cowardly Lion there.
That's right. But yes, R. Carney, he was a fantastic actor. I mean,
oh, definitely.
I know this is not one of the Twilight Zone's fabulous episodes, but you know, R. Carney, the guy was inimitable. I mean, he's just a wonderful actor. He's great comedy talent, and he was unsurpassed on The Honeymooners. So, you know, I just I'm looking forward to actually discussing that one in 2 weeks.
You know, what was kind of neat was when I was. Usually every year I try to find some old Christmas shows to watch and stuff like that, and I came across an old Honeymooners episode, which was a Christmas episode that they did, and I thought it was so nice that at the very end...
The very end, they all stood together,
yep,
and they
break
said,
the fourth
yep,
wall.
I remember that episode,
yep.
The whole cast stood there and said, Merry Christmas, yeah. Remember
yeah, Gleason goes, I don't usually go out of character. But we just all wanted to wish you a Merry Christmas. Yeah, that was cool.
That's right. I remember that episode. I thought that was so cool. That was very cool. Yeah, I remember that. And they did. You know, actually, the same thing happened with I Love Lucy.
Mm-hmm.
I Love Lucy did a Christmas episode where they all went out of character and they stood and said Merry Christmas to everyone. Yes, very, very nice episodes where they did that at the end.
Yeah, but
yeah.
Art Carney, great actor, so yeah, looking forward to this in a couple weeks.
Yeah. Okay, so Saturday, March 12th, we'll be here again, right? Right, Dave?
Dave?
All right. So if no one else has anything else to add, we will see you again 2 weeks from now for Night of the Meek. Okay, goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.